Okay, let's crank it up here. You can pick up the exams afterwards if you want. I think people did well on the exam. Congratulations, you've learned something. And now we're on to the history. Remember, last time we got to the beginning of the 19th century in the work of Berzelius, Jöns Jakob Berzelius in Sweden, who analyzed 2,000 compounds in 6 years. As you'll notice through the 19th century, analysis is the main technique, finding out what chemical elements are present in a pure substance. So he got good atomic weights for 50 elements and studied electrolysis, the theory of dualism, did a lot of teaching and writing, and developed, as we mentioned last time, the notation for composition that we use now, where he developed the symbols we use for the elements and the idea of writing little numbers next to them to say what ratio they're in, atomic ratio. So he needed a table of atomic weights. This is his table from 1831. And if we look in on it, you see there are two columns here. One is based on the atom oxygen being 100. These are the weights of the atoms then. Or you could take the weight of hydrogen being 1. Now notice, incidentally, that there are bars across some of these. Here's hydrogen's got a bar on it here. Sulfur with a bar, phosphorus with a bar. Bar means double atoms, right? So this, in fact, is not what we would call H equal 1, but H2 equals 1, right? So you see that under that system, oxygen would be 8. 0.013, according to him. Okay, so if you scale this to compare with the modern version, where oxygen is 15.9994, then you see that hydrogen is off by about 1%, nitrogen by about 1%, sulfur by 0.4%, and phosphorus by 1%, compared to the values we now accept. So, how much improvement was this over Dalton? Remember how precise Dalton's atomic weights were? You know, 20 years earlier, roughly? They were in the neighborhood of 10% off, or 15% off, even. So, Berzelius made a lot of improvement in that, a tenfold increase in accuracy from Dalton. Okay, one of the other things Berzelius did was to develop a much improved combustion analysis scheme compared to that big machine that we saw Lavoisier had 20 or 30 years earlier. So this was his diagram of that apparatus, the way of doing combustion analysis to find out how much carbon and hydrogen were in a substance. So what he did was take a tube that's about half an inch in diameter, and he put a dry powder in there, which consisted about half a gram of what he wanted to analyze, to burn, 3 grams of sodium chlorate. And remember, we mentioned last time that Gay-Lussac had figured out that sodium chlorate was a much better oxidizing agent than air, so that it would burn things that wouldn't burn normally. And 50 grams of sodium chlorate, just so it wouldn't explode, to dilute it. Okay, then he would heat the neck of that after putting the powder in and draw it out, and put it in the top there, join it with rubber tubing to a bulb and a tube that contained a drying agent. So now as water came out, it would go into either the bulb or the drying agent, and then you could weigh those before and after to see how much water, therefore how much hydrogen there was in the sample. Then he assembled it together in this big long thing at the bottom, and at the end he had one of these bell jars in which to contain contain the gas that was given off by combustion, CO2, and of course O2 also, because he's going to heat it and the sodium chlorate will give off O2. So there'll be both O2 and CO2 that collect in that jar. So you've got to separate them to know how much CO2 is. So he had this little bulb which he put glove leather over the top and tied a little thing around it up here in the top, so that the gases could diffuse slowly in and out. And in that, he put a potassium hydroxide, solid potassium hydroxide, which would absorb the CO2 and not the oxygen. So then he What he did was build a fire from front to back, keep moving coals back to heat it slowly. And notice that he had wrapped the tube with metal to keep it from popping under the pressure that would be generated in order to blow stuff through the mercury and collect in the jar. So over on the right then you see that the gas collected. And then at the end the fire went out, it pulled back again, but now you've got the oxygen and CO2, but the KOH will slowly absorb the CO2, and then you can take it out, take the glove off the top, and weigh it carefully. Now you've got to be sure that all the CO2 gets absorbed. So he had to wait 12 hours after the mercury stopped rising. As the gas started being absorbed, the mercury would rise, of course, as you remove the CO2. Then when it stopped and he knew the CO2 had mostly been absorbed, he waited 12 hours to make sure he got it all. And then he could take it apart, take the glove leather off the top, weigh it, and find out how much CO2. So by weighing this part of that, he got the water. By weighing this before and after, he got the CO2. And that's how he did his analysis. Okay. So another contribution he made was to involving electricity. Now, another person who was deeply involved in that was Humphrey Davy at the Royal Institution in London. This is a Gilray cartoon of the Royal Institution in 1802, where a bunch of the society would gather and hear lectures on science. And here you see Thomas Young generating N2O, laughing gas, to demonstrate on this member of the nobility. This guy here, incidentally, is the father of Benjamin Disraeli, the politician later in life. And this guy is Count Rumford, who founded the Royal Institution. But the guy here is Humphrey Davy, who was an important chemist. Now, he was important for his work with gases, but for other things as well, in particular with electricity, electrolysis. So just a few years earlier, Alessandro Volta in Italy had discovered what's called the voltaic pile, this thing here in 1799, which allowed generating, which was essentially a battery. So he found if you put copper and zinc together and wires on it, then you can get a little spark. So you know from that's a 1.1 volts you get from that. Suppose you want to get more volts, what do you do? Anybody remember this kind of thing? If you want to get more than 1 volt, which you get by putting copper and zinc together? Yeah. Right, not parallel, in series, right? So you put a bunch of them together like that. So in the Royal Institution, Humphrey Davy got 1 square foot pieces of copper and zinc and put them together and put 22 of them together, and then he could get 26 volts. Right, or he got, and there's a picture of a battery actually used by Berzelius. The pieces of metal are about that big around in that one. Okay, or Davy took 6 by 6 inch squares of and put a whole bunch of them together to get 110 volts. Right, or he could take 4 by 4 inch squares and put a bunch of them together to get 165 volts, or he could connect all these things together in series. Right, and then he could get 301 volts. Okay, so he did this, and then he tried to put it on in with several different solutions and see what you could get. So here's his description from 1808. I acted upon aqueous solutions of potash, that's potassium hydroxide, and soda, sodium hydroxide, saturated at common temperatures by the highest electrical power I could command, which was produced by a combination of voltaic batteries belonging to the Royal Institution containing 24 plates of copper and zinc, 12 inches square, 100 plates 6 inches, and 150 of a 4 inches square. That's what I showed you. So you get over 300 volts. Though there was a high intensity of action, that's not too surprising. The water of the solution alone was affected. Hydrogen and oxygen disengaged with the production of much heat and violent effervescence. Okay, so it was exciting, but not really exciting because only the water did anything, which is what happened before. So what did he do? The presence of water appearing thus to prevent any decomposition, I used potash in igneous fusion. This must have been fun to see. By means of a stream of oxygen gas from a gasometer applied to a flame of a spirit lamp, so methanol oxygen flame, right? which was thrown on a platina spoon containing potash, this alkali was kept for some minutes in a strong red heat and in a state of perfect fluidity. The spoon was preserved in communication with the positive side of the battery of the power of 106 inches, highly charged, and the connection from the negative side was made by platinum wire. So imagine this thing. He had the, you know, 100 volts going into this thing, and it was red hot, and the potash was melted. By this arrangement, some brilliant phenomena were produced. The potash appeared a conductor in a high degree, and as long as the communication was preserved, a most intense light was exhibited at the negative wire, and a column of flame, which seemed to be owing to the development of combustible matter, arose at the point of contact. So this was exciting stuff to do. A small piece of pure potash, which had been exposed for a few seconds to the atmosphere so as to give a conducting power to the surface, was placed upon an insulated dish of platina connected to the negative side of the battery of a power of 250, 6 and 4, in a state of intense activity, and a platina wire communicating with the positive side was brought in contact with the upper surface of the alkali. Small globules having a high metallic luster and being precisely similar in visible characters to quicksilver, that is mercury, appeared, some of which burnt with explosion and bright flame as soon as they were formed, and others remained and were merely tarnished and finally covered by a white film which formed on their surfaces. So what was this? He had potassium hydroxide, put the voltage to it, and got a metal that looked like mercury. Shiny silver metal. Any idea? So it's potassium hydroxide, K plus, OH minus, right? And he changes the electrical charge in the things. What do you get? Potassium metal. So this is the discussion. So potassium comes from potash. Sodium comes from soda, right? He did that too. So they're discovering new elements, okay, by this technique. So this was a great triumph for England, which didn't go unnoticed in France. And bear in mind, this is 1878, 1809, and this is the Napoleonic era. And Napoleon asked his scientists why they hadn't done it. They said they didn't have a battery big enough. He said, that's no excuse. You have all you want. Go to it. So they built this battery, La Grande Batterie. In fact, when this thing was inaugurated, they published a two-volume memorial of the occasion called Physico-Chemical Research by Gay Lussac. So Gay Lussac was the guy who built this thing. So what it included 601 kilogram copper plates and 603 kilogram zinc plates, so 2.6 tons of metal in these basins, and then they were connected together in series by these wires going across, and finally together with 650 volts. Okay, now Napoleon came to see this when it was done. He was an impetuous person. So this is from the life of Sir Humphrey Davy. It says, on Napoleon's alluding to the taste produced by contact of two metals, with that rapidity which characterized all his motions, and before the attendants could interpose any precaution, he thrust the extreme wires of the battery under his tongue and received a shock which nearly deprived him of sensation. After recovering from its effects, he quitted the laboratory without making any remark and was never afterwards heard to refer to the subject. Okay, so there's Napoleon. Okay, but the English came back, and in the basement of the Royal Institution, they built this battery, which generated 2,200 volts. Okay, and with this, they created all these... made for the first time all these new elements, the ones in blue there, boron, sodium, magnesium, potassium, calcium, and barium. So they were finding new pure elements. Now, but electricity supplied more than new elements. It also supplied the organizing principle for dualism, the theory, the idea that elements are held together by being positive and negative, right? So remember we talked about these chemical symbols from Sweden before, and the idea that if you had vitriolum cupri, which is copper sulfate, So they mixed this with caustic soda, with sodium hydroxide. So you have sodium hydroxide and the copper sulfate. You mix them together and change partners. Right? So you get AD and CB. So you can mix these, and you have dark blue copper sulfate, which when you mix it gives a precipitate, which is a light blue copper hydroxide. In fact, you get lots of different things depending on just how much base you put in and so on, but that's an additional complication that they didn't address. But the idea that you could have double decomposition, two salts which both decompose by exchanging one of their elements each. So this was explained by electricity, that things hold together, positive with negative. And this was called dualism, that there were two kinds of things, positive things and negative things. And the idea of electronegativity began to arise at those that period. In 1837, the first use in English of the word electronegativity came from James Dwight Dana. This is from the Oxford English Dictionary. He is quoted from his System of Mineralogy, saying, "When chemistry is so far advanced that the relative electronegativity, if I may so call it, or electropositivity of the several elements is fully known, we shall probably be able to construct a natural arrangement of minerals on chemical principles." Now, does anybody know anything about James Dwight Dana? In fact, that book, System of Mineralogy, is still in print in about its 12th edition or something like that. It's the Bible of mineralogists. But this is a picture of James Dwight Dana, 1813 to 1895, and this is his house. Did anybody walk by there this morning? You know where it is? It's on Hillhouse Avenue, by next to the bridge. Okay. He was the son-in-law of Benjamin Silliman, who lived across the street. I think it might be that house that Silliman lived in. Okay, so we were talking about how our cousins developed structural theory of organic chemistry. We talked first of Lavoisier, now of Gay-Lussac, Berzelius, elemental analysis, and the theory of atoms and the theory of dualism. Right, and now we're going to go on a little bit further to new theory, new experiments, and new theory. The experiment involves urea and benzoyl and substitution, and the theories are radical in type, and in particular this idea of isomers, which I think we'll get to today. So it's a new generation of people who are involved. In France, it's Jean-Baptiste André Dumas. And in Germany, Justus Liebig and Friedrich Wöhler. Incidentally, notice that the timeline here is the time when these ideas or experiments were developed, right? And these are where the people were born. So you can get, if Wöhler did isomers about here in 1828, you can see about how old he was. Okay, he was 27 years old, I guess. Okay, so here's on the front of the building, so we're going to speak about Wöhler and Liebig now. So this is Wöhler in 1823 writing to Berzelius in Sweden, saying, "Having developed the greatest respect for you through studying your writings, I've always thought it would be my greatest good fortune to be able to practice this science under the direction of such a man, which has always been my fondest desire." If you see letters applying for positions nowadays, they aren't so very different from that. Okay, that's where he says it here. Okay, and ends with "the greatest respect, Friedrich Wöhler from Frankfurt am Main." So he went up and worked with Berzelius, and they became great friends and carried on correspondence for the rest of their lives. This is from a letter in 1837 from Wöhler to Berzelius, and gives you an idea of Wöhler's personality. He said, "To see this old friend again, especially here in Göttingen, was a real delight. He was just the same old guy, with the sole exception that he no longer wears the little toupee swept up over his forehead as he used to do." And that's a cartoon he wrote in his letter. He was a very nice guy, I think, Wöhler. Had a good sense of humor. In contrast, as you'll see, to Liebig. Okay, so in 1828, many of you will have heard, I think, of urea being something that disposed of the idea of vitalism. But it was actually much more important in another way with respect to organic chemistry. Incidentally, there's some problems for Monday that you'll see on the web in relation to this work of Wöhler. So this is a letter written at that time from Wöhler to Prezelius. He was now back in Germany and working very hard at teaching, and he had very little time for research. He said, "Perhaps you will still remember the experiments I carried out in that fortunate time when I was working with you in Stockholm, in which I found that whenever one tries to react cyanic acid with ammonia, a crystalline substance appears which is inert, behaving neither like cyanate nor like ammonia." Okay, so it doesn't behave like these things anymore. Something fundamental has happened. Now, what he had planned to do was a double decomposition reaction. So he takes ammonium chloride and silver cyanate, and they trade partners, so you should get ammonium cyanate and silver chloride, which is a precipitate, so then you'd have ammonium cyanate. So now you can test your solution and see if it's ammonium cyanate. You can see if it has the properties of things that have ammonium ion in them. We call it ion, he didn't, that have ammonia in them, in it, and things that have cyanate. So ammonia, if treated with base, is known to give, ammonium is known to give the smell of ammonia, and it didn't do that, right? So it was not like an ammonium salt, the product of this, right? And furthermore, you didn't get the smell of cyanic acid when you treated it with acid. They smelled all sorts of things in those days, right? Or if you treated it with lead, you didn't get lead cyanate. So it seemed not to be behaving properly for these double decomposition reactions. Okay? So it was not like a cyanate salt. But if treated with nitric acid, it gave brilliant crystal flakes. And he had seen such flakes before. Those flakes looked just like those that you got when you treated urea with nitric acid. Okay? So the thought was that this stuff had given something new that was like urea. And Berzelius responded to Wöhler, "It's a unique situation that the salt nature so entirely disappears when the acid and ammonia combine, one that will certainly be most enlightening for future theory." So the question is, might ammonium cyanate actually be urea? Okay. And Wöhler wrote to Berzelius, "I recently performed a small experiment appropriate to the limited time I have available, which I quickly completed and which, thank God, did not require a single analysis." Remember how laborious these analyses were. So he didn't have to do an analysis because Dr. Prout in London, a physician, had already analyzed urea. Okay? So in 1817, he had published that this was the analysis of urea. It contained nitrogen, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen in those ratios. Okay, and now, since Berzelius had developed good atomic weights, and they knew what the formula should be for ammonium and for cyanate, right? They could figure out from, in theory, what analysis you should get if urea was ammonium cyanate. Okay, and you should get these, right? Now, the discrepancies are less than 2%, so that's about what they were getting many times now in this period, so that looked reasonable. They were the same thing, as far as you could tell, by analysis. And if you compare it, incidentally, with modern values for the percentages you should get, they are these. Now, let's look at this. This is Prout's experiment, and this is Berzelius' theory. Which is better? That is Berzelius' atomic weights and the idea that what you get is ammonium cyanate. Okay? So the agreement is better on the left than the right. Seems to be a lesson there. The moral is don't dry lab, report what you actually see, not what you thought you should see. Right? And then 200 years later, you have better values than you did from theory. That seems to be the lesson. Okay? So that's a valuable lesson, but it's worth exploring it a little further. Notice that Dr. Prout's sum is not 100%. Does that surprise you? Remember that Lavoisier always got 410 grams, no ounces, no grow, no grains. Does it surprise you that it doesn't sum to 100? No, it just shows that he was honest, right? He didn't jigger his figures so they'd come out to be 100, it would appear. Okay, so because of that, and because these numbers are so good, Prout has become, for historians of chemistry, a paragon of accuracy and honesty, a real hero. But it's worth looking at this a little bit further. Okay, first look here that this does not sum to 100% either. Now, how do you go about getting these numbers if you know how many atoms there are there and what their atomic weights are. You multiply the number of atoms of a certain kind by the atomic weight. You get how much weight there should be of that one, of the next, of the next, of the next. You add them together to get the total, right? Then you divide each one by the total to get what percent it is. Okay? So what should you get when you add those numbers all together? You should get 100. This isn't being candid. This is being incompetent somehow. This is from Wohler's paper. Now, why? How come it came out to be 99.8 instead of 100? Well, you can recalculate it using Berzelius numbers, and you get 100%, of course, and you get these. Now, compare those. Look here, for example. What happened? This is what Wohler reported in his paper. This is what you can recalculate. Why is he off here? He rounded down instead of up. Or just, actually what he did was truncate. He just took off the last number, right? Whereas now we know you should round up. But these were early days of doing high precision stuff, right? So they hadn't developed that idea carefully yet. Okay. So it was truncated instead of rounding up. But that only is going to make a difference in this last digit, right? That's not going to make this much difference. Do you see any other problems? Right? He was dyslexic, maybe. He wrote 2-4 instead of 4-2. But the interesting thing is he didn't notice that when he added it wasn't 100%. Right? Because these are early days. Berzelius has always added up to 100%, but his student Wohler occasionally made mistakes and didn't notice that it should have added to 100%. Okay, now let's look back at Dr. Prout over here. His total 99.875, which looks like experimental candor. But let's think about how he did this. Okay, nitrogen, it turned out he got by volume of nitrogen gas. Carbon and hydrogen by combustion. But how did he get oxygen? He got oxygen by difference. Right? So it had to sum to 100% because he didn't measure oxygen directly. Okay, now just consider. Oh, incidentally, they added the numbers wrong. It should be much closer. Okay. Now, this is what Prout gets his laurel wreath for, right? That's exactly right to a part they're the same to this position. A part in 5,000, two parts in 10,000, 0.02%. That's really, really good. Now, how did he get such good things? Well, I mentioned that he determined N2 by the volume of gas. Okay? So first he had to measure a volume that accurately, but also he had to know the temperature and the pressure that accurately to within 0.02%. Do you think that's likely? Not very likely that you could measure that accurately. So perhaps he was just lucky. He said, and in fact, what he reported was 6.3 cubic inches, not 6.3287 or something like that, which is, of course, reasonable. He could measure it about that with that precision to about 1%. Okay? So was he just lucky to happen to get it correct to two parts in 10,000? No. Because he had a theory, too, about what atoms were made of. He had the idea that hydrogen was what he called protyle. Ele prote means the matter, the primary matter. So everything was made of hydrogen, right? So carbon was made of 6 hydrogens, oxygen of 8 hydrogens, nitrogen of 14 hydrogens, right? So then all you have to do is an approximate analysis to get what integral ratio the atoms are in. You know, within a few percent, right? So from that, he figured that the approximate atom ratios were 1 to 1 to 2 to 1, right? That's what he got from 6.3 cubic inches of nitrogen, right? And then he can use his atomic weights to calculate what these should be, right? So in fact, Prout did dry lab because he made an approximate analysis and reported results which were corrected by his theory. Right, so much for the honesty and accuracy of Dr. Prout. Right, you can tell that to historians of chemistry. But notice that his theory was better than Berzelius' experiments. At first we said that his experiments were better than Berzelius' theory. But in fact, it's backwards. Berzelius, by his experiments, determined atomic weights. But Prout's theory that carbon is made of protons, of hydrogen, is in fact a better theory than Berzelius' experiments were. So that's just sort of cute. Shows that you have to be careful about lessons. Okay, now, let's rehearse a little bit about ammonium reacting with cyanate. So what makes NH4 reactive? What orbital are you going to look for there? What we did in the first half of the semester is not irrelevant to this. So what orbital is going to make this reactive, localized orbital? Ellen, you got any idea? NH LUMO, sigma star. And what will make this reactive? You're on a roll, continue. The lone pair, the high homo. It's got a negative charge too, right? So we've got the sigma star here and the unshared pair here. So we're going to make a bond and break a bond, right? And transfer a proton to get that. But now those two things can react together. Arvind, what's going to make this thing reactive? Right, the high homo, the unshared pair, and here? Carbon, oxygen, LUMO. Somebody give me a name for that? Pi star. Okay, there we go. So N and pi star, so those are going to react. So the N will attack the pi star, and we can draw a curved arrow like that. And now then we could put the unshared pair out, make and break, as we did before. But notice that it would have been possible to go the other way, to attack the CN double bond, too. Okay, now, if you attack the CN double bond, you'd get this, right? And if you had that, if you attack the CO double bond, you'd get that. But those two things are resonance structures of each other, right? So it's really only one thing you're getting. Okay, now the next stage is that you have a HOMO here that can attack a LUMO, although it probably doesn't do that within a molecule because the overlap is not good between this one which is big out here where you want to attack it and this one which is down here. So probably it happens between molecules, not within a molecule. But at any rate, you can have that N attack sigma star, get a proton transfer, probably not within one molecule. Right, and that would give this, transfer the hydrogen here that was formerly on the nitrogen. Right? Or you could, had you used the other resonance structure, you could have transferred it that way. Again, probably intermolecular, and you'd put the hydrogen from NH2 down here. But those two things can be interconverted by taking a proton off one side and putting it on the other. So in fact, you'd get this one, which is the lower energy one, because we've talked before about the CO bond being so very stable. But that's lore. We don't really know that for sure yet until we see a lot more examples. So that's urea. So that's how ammonium cyanate goes to urea. But that raises the question, can you have ammonium cyanate, or does it always react to give urea? Is there such a thing as a salt ammonium cyanate? And that wasn't truly known until 1998, right? When our old friend Dunitz in Switzerland determined the X-ray crystal structure of ammonium cyanate, which is hard because you can't get single crystals of it. It was done with X-ray of a powder, which is a much more complicated thing to do. But you can see here that there's the ammonium ion, clearly enough, inside a box whose corners are oxygen and nitrogen atoms. Okay. Now, what in this paper where Wohler made urea, he said, I refrain from all the considerations which so naturally suggest themselves from this fact that ammonium cyanate is urea. Okay. Especially in respect to the composition ratios of organic substances and in respect to similar elemental and quantitative compositions among compounds with very different properties. So urea and ammonium cyanate, the salt, are completely different, but they have the same elements in the same ratios. People's imagination is always limited by what they're able to do. So if what they could do was measure weight ratios of elements, they thought that must be all there is to it. right? But what this showed was that there's more to it. You can have the same elements in the same ratios, but they could either have an organic compound, urea, or you could have a salt, ammonium cyanate. So as may be supposed, among others, of fulminic acid and cyanic acid, and of a liquid hydrocarbon and the olefiant gas, which we'll be discussing later. And it must be left to further investigation of many similar cases to decide what general laws can be derived therefrom, that there's more to chemicals than just what elements there are and in what ratio. Okay. Now, fulminic and cyanic acid was very important with respect to the relationship between Wöhler and Liebig, the other person we're going to talk about, as we'll see very shortly. But Berzelius, to whom Wöhler sent this letter in 1828, the one we've just been talking about and which was then published, in 1830 published his own paper on the composition of tartaric acid and racemic acid, which is also called John's acid from the Vosges, on the atomic weight of lead oxide, together with several remarks on these substances, which have the same composition but different properties, right? Things that have the same elements and the same ratios. So he would write the same formula for them, you know, C12H24O2 or something like that, right? But they have different properties. Okay. Now, one example. This is tartaric acid. I'll pass this around. A graduate student brought me this cork from a wine bottle, and you see it has beautiful crystals on the top. Look at the crystals. Right here we can blow them up a little bit. Here. They have just beautiful facets on them. And we did X-ray structure on one of a crystal we took off that cork, and it's calcium tartrate, tetrahydrate. Okay, so Berzelius said about this, I've thought, so that's the subject of this, the tartaric acid salts. I thought it necessary to choose between the words homosynthetic and isomeric substances. The former is built from homos, equivalent, and synthetos, put together. The latter from isomeres has the same meaning, although it only properly says put together from the same pieces. The latter has the advantage with respect to brevity and euphony. Thus I've decided to choose it. He says it's easier to say isomer than to say homosynthetic, right? So this is the coining the word isomer. So there can be isomers, the same element, same atom, same ratio, but different somehow. Now what's the nature of that difference is what's to be found over the next 30 years or so. And it's brevity and euphony that decided the choice. By isomeric substances, I understand those which possess the same chemical composition and the same atomic weight, by which he meant molecular weight, but different properties. Okay, same composition, but different properties. So there's more to chemistry than what Berzelius would write. So what he wrote was composition, what elements in what ratio, right? But there are three more C's that characterize organic substances, and they have to do with the arrangement of the atoms, with the structure of a certain set of atoms. So these further things that we need to know are constitution, which comes in 1858, configuration, which comes in 1874, and conformation, which comes first raises its head about 1890, but wasn't really studied carefully until the 1950s. So these are the aspects of organic structure that we're going to see how they developed so that we understand them better. But you got to be patient. It takes a while to get that far. Okay, incidentally, with respect to cyanic acid, there was a very careful calculation done in 2004 to get the energies of the various isomers of cyanic acid. So that one, compared to the elements, is -27.8 kilocalories per mole. And if you take the same thing but put the hydrogen on the other end, the same arrangement of NCO, then it's 30 kilocalories higher. So the bottom one is much more stable. But you can also put the N in the middle, and that's plus 41. And you can put the hydrogen on the other end of that one, plus 56. So the ones on the top, the anion on the top, CNO, is much less stable than the NCO on the bottom. And remember, we had a problem about this very early on where you were supposed to draw all the resonance structures for these things and decide which ones were more stable, which it turns out to be impossible, really, without doing some kind of calculation. Okay, so cyanic acid was being studied by Wöhler. That's how he got to urea. But fulminic acid was being studied by Liebig. And the reason was that he was, like many young men, was interested in explosions. And the Latin fulmen means lightning. So fulminic acid really explodes. The metal salts of fulminates are used as primary explosives, very sensitive things. So here's a picture of Justus Liebig, who was 3 years younger than Wöhler. And in 1824, he was in Paris working with Gay Lussac, whom we've been talking about, on silver fulminate. Notice that in this portrait, he has his device here, which is this thing. And incidentally, Gay Lussac was the one who noticed that the analyses he was getting of silver fulminate was the same as Wöhler's analysis of sodium cyanate. So these things are isomers of one another. One has the C in the middle, one has the N in the middle. Okay? But this device over here is an interesting one. I'm sure you've seen that. Does anybody know what it is? You came into this building today, and if you'd looked up to the left as you went along the walk on the far side there, you'd see that thing, which is exactly the same thing that's in Liebig's picture. And if you go into the chemistry library, you see a carving that's that. And if you look at the logo of the American Chemical Society, you see exactly the same thing. Most people think that's some sort of alchemical symbol, but it's not. What it is this thing here, which is how Liebig did analysis. He developed this in 1831, and it was by far the best way of doing organic analysis, of measuring carbon and hydrogen. So you had a tube, much like Berzelius did here, in which you put coals to heat the thing up and do the combustion, right? And then you have a very small tube here that has a drying agent to collect water. And then this thing, which collects the CO2. Now I want to show you... So there's the water collector. There's the CO2 collector. And notice it's got a little wedge there. That's interesting. I have a model of it here. So it looks like this. It's called the five-bulb apparatus, the Fünfkugel apparat. So or the Kali apparat, because it has potassium hydroxide in here that's going to absorb CO2. Same idea as what Lavoisier did 40 years earlier, right? But what's different is... that you have these five bulbs. So the CO2 that's coming out goes in here. So as it bubbles through here, it stirs itself, right? So you don't have to have some guy, as Lavoisier did, standing there to stir it. But it's tilted, remember? It's tilted like this. And that makes it even better, the bubbling. But notice something special. This thing is made out of fairly thick walled glass, but his had to be made out of very thin glass. Why? Why do you want it to be as thin as possible, the glass? How are you going to measure the CO2? By weighing before and after. If this thing weighs 10 tons and you get a milligram of CO2, you're not going to be able to measure it. You want everything else to be as light as possible, so you get the biggest fractional change. So it has to be as small as possible. But within that constraint, this bulb is bigger than this bulb. Now, why is that? It's because if you're doing this, while the gas is being evolved, it's going like this. But at the end, you're going to turn the fire down. So it's going to cool. And then what will happen when it cools on the left here? When the gas on the left becomes cool, yeah? It'll draw back, so it'll do this. So this one has to be big enough to hold all the liquid. This one doesn't. Right, so to make it as small as possible, you make this. So there's a lot of lore involved in doing things like this, and people needed to learn how to do this, because with this thing, there, notice it's tilted. There's another example where it's tilted, and the bulbs are different size, and it's cushioned because the things are so delicate. And here's the last surviving one, which is in Germany at Liebig's laboratory in Gießen. Actually, that's not the last surviving one. The last surviving one is in a case that's right next to this. But again, notice it's big and small here. but it hasn't been tilted as it's supposed to be. So the gas comes in and through and out, and then when it sucks back, the in one has to be big enough to hold everything. Okay, this is a portrait of Liebig later in life when he was a professor in Munich, and you notice he's chosen to have in the picture this. But if you look very carefully at that, and you see the bulbs are different sizes, but if you look very carefully at that, you see that it goes in through the small bulb and out through the big bulb. It's hooked up backwards. It's interesting to know how many students he must have told why the bulbs were different size and it has to be connected this way, not the other way. And then when they come to do his portrait, he connects it backwards. I think that's just amazing. That's his laboratory, his teaching laboratory in Gießen, where that stuff is. And this is some of his scientific descendants. This is an old diagram from that museum. And all the red ones got the Nobel Prize in chemistry, which isn't surprising because everyone went to study with Liebig to learn how to use this machine. That's why it became the logo of the American Chemical Society in the 1860s when the society was founded. That was the major apparatus in use in organic chemistry during the 19th century. Okay, and in fact, included in his scientific descendants are you. Because here's T.W. Richards, who was the teacher of Conant, who was the teacher of Bartlett, who was the teacher of me, who was the teacher of you. Okay, this is his laboratory then in Gießen. So you see these people have come from all over to study. For example, this man, Ortigosa, here, came from Mexico. And he was supposed to be the best. He's the only one in this picture who gets to hold the five bulb apparatus. Right, and he was said to be the best of all. He was better than Liebig at doing these analyses. But notice, the artist has drawn him holding this thing upside down so the potassium hydroxide would run out onto his trousers here. This is really sort of funny. There's actually another picture of the same scene in which he's holding it right side up. And this guy over here in the fancy hat and long coat is Hoffmann. And there's this monument to Hoffmann, and it says down below, a master of and glittering teacher of chemistry, the triumphant discoverer of aniline and the aniline dyes. And we'll be talking more about him. His father was an architect and wanted him to study architecture, but when he went to the university, he was so taken by Liebig's teaching that he became a very important chemist. And he's the one who imported modern chemistry into Britain, as we'll see. But back here, there's something which looks like someone looking in a window. But actually, I'm pretty sure it must be this bust of Liebig, which is still present there. If you go, you can put your hand around his shoulder, too. Now, in 1832, the radical theory developed. So I'm just going to introduce it here in the correspondence of Liebig and Wöhler. So in the winter of 1825, they first met in Frankfurt. They'd communicated before because Gay-Lussac had noticed they were analyzing, getting the same analyses for different salts. In 1830, they first used the familiar second person do instead of z. So they became really good friends. And then in 16 May 1832, Wöhler wrote, "I long to do some more significant work. Shouldn't we try to shed some light on the confusion about the oil of bitter almonds? But where to get material? Nowadays, you can just order it. Here's a bottle of the oil of bitter almonds." So smell it. There. You notice an odor?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can pass it along. Don't drop it. Don't take the top off, okay? But notice the odor. Got it? What, you know what the odor is? Well, we'll see as it goes around. But anyhow, just less than a month later, Liebig wrote back and said, "My poor dear Wöhler, how empty is every comfort against such a loss," because Wöhler's young wife had just died in that intervening time. "When I think how content and happy you were during your move to his new position in Göttingen, when I think how content and happy you were during your move, what attachment and love you had for one another, the good wife so young, so full of life, so irreplaceable for her parents and for you, come to us, dear Wöhler. Although We may not be able to give you comfort. We will perhaps be able to help you bury your grief. Staying in Kassel at this time would only be detrimental to your health. We need to be busy with something. I've just been able to get some amygdalin from Paris, and I'm ordering 25 pounds of bitter almonds. So he's going to get this stuff that they want to study. So that's what the way he'll deal with his grief. You must not travel. You must busy yourself, but not in Kassel. I haven't had the courage to tell my wife yet. I can only tell her bit by bit because I know how much this will affect her. Come to us. I expect you at the end of this week. So during the next couple weeks, they worked on this oil of bitter almonds, that stuff that's coming around, right? And they developed a brand new theory of organic chemistry, and that's what we'll talk about next time. Good. Yeah, okay, good. Josh Baraban. Was he a TA when you were? Was Josh Baraban?
No. Chuck and
he was the peer tutor, Josh was. But he must have gone. He had not gone by the time you came.
We had Micah and Edmund.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. Because Josh was the one who brought in that.